The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Tom Clark. Nuts in May, the Tories go tonto over Europe again, as David Cameron concedes new ground to his Eurosceptic backbenchers. Is he leading or following on the road to an in-out referendum? And where does it leave the increasingly fractious relations between the coalition partners? And should Labour sit this one out or commit to a referendum of its own? Also this week, life to mean life for cop killers who will face prison without the possibility of parole under new proposals from the Home Secretary. And across the channel, an unhappy anniversary. President François Hollande marks a year in office, watching France dip into a new recession. We'll hear from our Paris correspondent, Angélique Chrysaphis. But first, joining me here in the studio, I have the political columnist Melissa Kite, the Guardian social affairs editor Randeep Ramesh, and the editor of Lib Dem Voice, Stephen Tall. A warm welcome to you all. Now, if David Cameron thought he'd buried the issue of an EU referendum by promising to hold one, he had a rude awakening this week. Following record poll numbers from the UK Independence Party, he enraged his backbenchers by not laying the groundwork for the promised plebiscite in the Queen's speech. So having briefly stuck to his guns, Cameron then published a bill but told his MPs that due to disagreement within the coalition, it would not be debated in government time. Now, for some, this was still not enough and proof of the Prime Minister's venality. For onlookers not consumed with a complex debate, it was simply baffling. Melissa, you've been following the debate this week. Are there matters of principle at stake, really? Or is this just process, arguing about the type of process that often drives voters mad?
No, I think this goes quite deep, in fact, and it's if Europe isn't a deep enough issue, there are even other issues that the Tory backbenchers, right-wingers, feel even, you know, as strongly about at the moment. There is huge discontent with David Cameron's leadership, and this is like an iceberg, if you like, the tip of it sticking out with this sort of Europe rebellion, and underneath, under the surface, there is really a sort of simmering anger and, you know, a larger obstacle, if you like, which faces Cameron now as he leads this coalition and tries to keep fractious Tory MPs on board. And, you know, they are incredibly restive about the general direction that he is going in.
Now, there were 80-odd backbenchers, I think, demanding a referendum in October 2011. A year and a half later, the number's gone up to over 110, suggesting there's growing discontent. But you're saying that's not necessarily just discontent about Europe. It might be about other things. So what sort of other things? What could David Cameron do to try and calm his troops down?
Well, I draw the parallel with Maastricht, not just because there are obvious similarities that this is a Europe row, but because if you look at what was going on then, there was an economic crisis. I mean, if you talk to right-wingers, it's hard to see sometimes what they're more angry about. Is it Europe, the lack of a timetabled referendum on Europe, or is it his economic policy? And, for example, the lack of a growth strategy, the lack of firm, what they would believe would be firm action on taxation and growth.
Tax cuts, essentially.
Essentially, yes, or some other sort of drastic strategy to get the economy moving. So there is this sort of simmering kind of resentment, if you like, about a range of issues. Also, you have to remember that a lot of these Tory MPs are, they've got UKIP snapping at their heels. Mm. You know, they are themselves feeling very, very vulnerable. And, you know, the Tories have done their own internal research looking at why old traditional Tory voters in many areas are turning to UKIP. And interestingly, that is not just about Europe. That is about UKIP standing for what they feel they believe as traditional Tories. Mm. So firm policies on immigration, law and order, and, you know, a sense that Cameron doesn't really get what the Tory grassroots, you know, want, and that maybe UKIP is standing for the sorts of values, if you like, that they believe in. Now, you can argue with those values, but that is the sort of dilemma that many Tory MPs, especially in marginal seats, are facing.
Stephen, I mean, from a Liberal Democrat point of view, some of those values that aren't popular at the moment then with Conservative backbenchers on not banging on about Europe, not being tough enough on law and order, etc., the jettisoning of those values were the things that made Cameron an acceptable coalition partner in the first place. Do you see much left of the Cameron modernisation project?
It's 3 years since the coalition was formed, and the Tories haven't stopped having that argument yet about why it was they didn't beat Gordon Brown in May 2010. So they can't still forgive him for failing against the worst possible economic backdrop possible to actually defeat the Labour Party and get a majority in their own right. And if that wasn't bad enough, what Cameron next did wrong was offer a coalition. And increasingly, Tories have kind of felt that, why didn't he go for a minority government? Why didn't he try for a minority government for 5-6 months, put forward some really kind of deeply populist policies on welfare, on immigration, which the Lib Dems and Labour couldn't possibly support, and then trigger a second election in the same year, at which point Cameron may well have got a majority. Probably not a big majority, but he would probably got a majority, not least because the Lib Dems and Labour would have both been financially bankrupted by a second general election in the same year.
Is this your opinion or their reasoning?
I think it's both. And I think, to be fair to them, I think it's actually logically, it makes a lot of sense that I think if Cameron had gone down that route, the Conservatives would have got a working majority at a second general election in October 2010.
I think that's absolutely right. I think the Tory right think that they didn't win a majority because they weren't right-wing enough, whereas Cameron might argue the opposite. And they would rather have struggled from crisis to crisis and then gone back to the electorate to see if they can get a majority. They don't see how they can possibly increase their majority next time.
I think the Tory right are living in a land of illusions. I mean, the idea that if you'd made out that this was a terrific financial crash, you know, the coming of the second depression, to offer yourself up as a minority government with no executive strength and push through radical policies would have left you bereft of any mandate. In fact, the public would have seen through you quicker than you could have said, David Cameron's not my Prime Minister anymore.
But don't you think that what the Lib Dems would have done, what the Conservatives would have done then is say, look, Greece is burning, we've got a desperate need to introduce austerity measures. We can't do a deal with the Lib Dems or Labour. They're this kind of centre-left soft. They can't deal with economic policies in a rigorous enough way. You need a strong Conservative Party to lead this country. That would have been the argument they would have put forward.
That's tantamount to saying you were wrong, the public. And usually politicians who say that to the public end up in the dustbin of history. I think.
But the Tory right would argue that Cameron's headed for the dustbin of history anyway. The way things are going, they really don't believe, rightly or wrongly, and that, you know, they do not believe that he can increase his majority after this coalition.
It's always very
period.
Difficult for that to occur, given you're supposed to be at the high point when you take office. But I think without a sort of Falkland-style revival, I mean, those exceptional force de majeure events leave them out the picture. But I think you're right about the Tory party and the sort of the brief interludes where right-wing Tories will actually speak to someone like the social affairs editor of The Guardian. What I really sense is a very strong class antipathy to the sort of Notting Hill sort of set. I mean, the phrase is used so often, and they see them as these real lightweights, this PR man and his sort of buddy in number 11 who don't pay any attention to us. And they do admire, in a way, strangely enough, a bit of the coarser, red-blooded sort of fighting spirit that they think these two lack.
Yeah, there's a real divide in the Tory party between what they were, the meritocrats, as they would call themselves, the people who've come up by their bootstraps. And, you know, the Notting Hillers, who are sophisticated, public school educated, privileged, metrosexual, and all that. And they really dislike each other, these two wings of the Tory party. And I think that's right. A lot of it is that, and a lot of it is personal.
And I think the reason why Cameron didn't want to go for that minority government, followed by possibly a very small majority in October 2010 in that hypothetical election, is that he knew he would have to depend on Douglas Carswell, Peter Bone and so on. And he didn't want to do that. He was desperate to avoid having to be reliant on the right wing of his party. They know that. They can understand that's exactly why he'd rather deal with the Lib Dems rather than with the right wing of his own party. And that resentment is coming out. Last year it was the kiboshing of laws reform that was the trigger. And then this year it's Europe. Next year it'll be something else. But really it's the kickback against Cameron's dislike of his right wing.
And he'd rather be in a coalition next time, I think, than go on, lead a party that he had to struggle with like this. I mean, he maybe felt that he was safer with Nick Clegg by his side, as you say, than having to fight his own party. And this won't get through. You know, this rebellion won't get through because of the Lib Dems. And so I think Cameron does feel safer and almost more at home with his Lib Dem coalition partners than he does with his own party, which is very odd, and stokes the resentment in the party even further, I think.
What he's not doing, Melissa, I mean, if the early Cameron was all about modelling himself on Tony Blair, who just enjoyed nothing more than giving his own party a good kicking to demonstrate to the country he was above party. Whether it's out of weakness or out of a change of heart, Cameron's not doing that, is he, anymore, with this, you know, so-called rebellion of all these Tory MPs. But while the Prime Minister says, well, we're in profoundly relaxed, I think was the phrase, profoundly relaxed about people voting this, he's not giving that kind of lead against the right anymore. Is that because of weakness, do you think?
I think, I mean, he can say he's profoundly relaxed, but that's not the impression, and he may well be. I mean, I know people who know Cameron personally and say Dave is relaxed. You know, that's just the way he is. That's fine, you know. And he can be as relaxed as he wants to be. But if you talk to people in Number 10, you know, there is panic. There is a sense that, you know, how long can they sort of struggle on with this two parties, essentially, you know, and a split, you know, through his own ranks. So, yes, I'm sure he's relaxed. But that is not...
Isn't really the problem with the Tory right? They're condescended to a lot by the Notting Hill set. I mean, that seems to come out. You know, their economic policy of sort of cutting taxes, which is a good right-wing policy. You talk to the Treasury team, and they're like, but that would just leave us piling on debt in the short term. That's not the message we want to send out. It's intellectually incoherent. So you get this sort of slightly kind of waspish, kind of talking down, supercilious. And that sort of trickles back to me. And you hear it as a sort of, you know, tea room talk that, you know, they come round and monster us.
I think he does have a problem with how he handles them. And I think he could be a bit more conciliatory. And I think if it is about tone and about handling, and then this high-handed approach he has to his own right wing, you know, he could handle it better, maybe. Maybe they could be mollified. Maybe if he was a bit nicer to them, you know, they wouldn't be so abrasive. But you've got to remember that it goes back to, you know, the Tory grassroots in the country, the sorts of people who vote for the Tory party. You know, this is not about the Tory right saying, inventing a problem that doesn't exist. They are going back to their constituencies on Friday and being sort of, you know, bashed over the head by their sort of blue rinse brigade, who are, I mean, I heard from one Tory MP can't get any fundraising done, he's lost his donors, he's lost, you know, there is a real drift to UKIP that is actually happening, because they feel that it's not just Tory MPs who feel Cameron doesn't understand them, it's Tory voters.
So do you think it was just modernisation in image alone? Because they didn't transform the party really then, did they?
Well, you've got the same voters.
Stephen, let's just move on to the Liberal Democrats and where this leaves them. You know, Cameron's playing catch up with disgruntled parts of his party and the party in the country, as Melissa says. It's a very different tribe, isn't it, from the Liberal Democrats? And I mean, do you see this thing lasting still through till May 2015?
I still do, but only because I think both parties are clinging on for dear life and waiting for an economic uptick that actually feeds through into people's bank balances, that people actually feel like there's a real recovery as opposed to the kind of semi-recovery that we might be experiencing at the moment. So I think there's kind of, they're bound into this pact of mutually self-assured destruction, that there's no point blowing up the coalition at this point. Mm-hmm. And that argument has been the case for the last year and a half, and I don't see that changing. So the question then becomes, what actually can the coalition do in 2 years? 2 years is actually quite a long time to be in government. If you don't like each other and you're at each other's throats and you're just trying to block each other's worst bits of legislation the whole time. So that's why you saw quite an anemic Queen's speech, in which there were some substantial pieces of legislation in there, Social Care Act and so on. But generally, it was a very minimalist Queen's speech, because they actually don't have this joint agenda, this kind of liberal, conservative, internationalist, vaguely green kind of party that government that I think Cameron and Clegg hoped they'd be able to try and make last for 5 years. That has now gone, and we're left with two parties that can sort of tolerate each other a bit, only because they're hoping that their own popularity will pick up in time for May 2015.
But, I mean, you're going to see, Randy, aren't you, different ministers, once you're in that kind of dismal equilibrium, different ministers starting to blame everything on other ministers, and just keeping the show on the road would be very difficult once you've got those dynamics in play, can't it?
I think the process of differentiation took root with Eastleigh, and then after that the budget, and it's come to one of its high points with these elections. We know, and you can't have a coalition deputy prime minister being barracked by his own troops. That is just the signal that it's the end of the party now, please leave. So they were holding hands when they entered Downing Street. They'll be touching fingertips by 2015. I think the end of the romance is over. And the problem for the Lib Dems, I think, is the Orange Book faction which runs it, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, is looking over its shoulder at possible new entrants. I mean, people who can attack it both from the right and the left of the party. I mean, Sarah Tether is doing a very good job of being a very effective opposition MP to her own government. She's obviously got a seat to save, but I will expect to see a lot more of that on the Lib Dem side. I've noticed with the debates where the party leadership are calling for Lib Dems to appear, you don't see a lot of them.
Yeah, I mean, I would trace back the differentiation from before Easter. I mean, I'd trace it right the way back to AV referendum in 2011. That was when the joint project...
But they still work together, aren't
they? Yeah, yeah. No, it was a difference of degrees. But I think the moment that George Osborne unleashed the dogs of war on Nick Clegg in that referendum was the moment any kind of joint project died. Mm. It died that day. And also, it died the idea that Cameron was trying to reach out to a centre ground as well, because that was basically saying to the right wing of the Tory party, yes, I'm on your side. That was his attempt to try and reconcile himself to
the
right wing.
The predictors of doom just haven't been borne out, have they? Because this coalition just sort of endures. I mean, I've sort of compared it to a rusty old Volvo. You know, it just keeps going. You can't, because there is no alternative. And I don't know what Ed Miliband is doing quite. I mean, on this issue alone, for example, on Europe, He's not said, is he for, is he against a referendum? And so it struggles on. And there doesn't seem to be any obvious alternative outcome other than, if I was a betting woman, somehow there'd be another hung parliament and another coalition will be cobbled together at 2015. I can't see any other outcome at the moment. But I would keep my eye on UKIP, and after the European elections in 2014, I would imagine they were in an even stronger position and would even look like they were viable to win some Westminster seats, perhaps.
But do you think that if it looks close, could you start seeing... I mean, already Randeep talks about people like Sarah Tether who left the government, didn't choose to leave the government. But I'm wondering whether both the Conservative right-wing MPs you're talking about, who might be in the government already, and a few of the Lib Dems, might just say, actually, I want to get out of government a year or so ahead of this election in order to sort of look like I'm standing up for, you know, Northampton or wherever it is.
Just a mess, isn't it, in that sense? Because you've got two coalition partners who are wedded together. Okay, fine, you say they don't know there is a separation going on, but essentially, to all intents and purposes, they function as a unit, Cameron and Clegg. And then they are ranged against their own parties on either side. So there's a sort of weird love triangle, if you like. And we've not seen anything like it before. Maybe we will never recover from it, and we will never return back to the neat two-party system where we had one on, you know, and it was also, those days just seem so far gone, don't they?
There are areas of policy where the two do coalesce and work together quite effectively. I mean, social care they have done, and, you know, the Queen's Speech is a step forward.
Pensions,
Steve Webb, you know, same thing there. Where they clash, you know, over high-profile things like the environment, obviously that garners a lot more headlines, you know, than anything they might be doing in a sort of subterranean way. And I just don't think there's enough of it to last. There's not enough petrol in the tank to kind of really push the thing through.
Unless the economy picks up to the extent that they can go to the electorate in 2015 and say, we've done what we said on the tin, which was, OK, it ain't pretty, it doesn't look, you know, it's looked a bit of a mess, but we have got the show back on the road, and you put yourself forward again.
I think it's got to be in wallets rather than numbers. You know, if they just produce a load of GDP numbers saying that we're doing better, people won't.
But if there is a genuine feel good factor.
Yeah, it's got to be in your pocket.
I mean, I think there will be that first term sense of, we said we'd come in and clear up Labour's mess, and now look, the economy is recovering. And of course, there isn't a parallel universe in which you can work out whether or not Alistair Darling's plans would have been better. So you're left with the fact that the economy was sinking, and now there is some growth. It's anemic, but it's happening. So that's what they're hoping will happen in the next 2 years. And I guess from the Lib Dem point of view, what we're hoping happens is that some of the messages that we've been banging on about, but which haven't been heard, because we're just seen as an annex to the Tory party, that some of those messages might start to resonate. So the idea that cutting taxes for the low paid, first Lib Dem priority, has happened. The pupil premium has happened. So there have been big Lib Dem wins in the coalition, but I don't think if you asked the average person on the street, do you think the Lib Dem's policy is tax cuts for the low paid, they'd go, yeah, of course, that was in the Lib Dem manifesto.
Yeah,
now it's in government. Well done, mate.
Yeah. They wouldn't happen. Disentangle it all to say what it is about the success in 2015 that is a Lib Dem, made, and which bits of it are Tory made, and who benefits from that.
And we are just hoping that constant repetition that it was us who did
it. Stephen, if I put you on the spot, given you've got a limited number of MPs, how many MPs do you really think you're going to get in 2015?
I honestly don't know, but I mean, the local elections, I mean, the because of UKIP taking away predominantly from the Conservatives, the estimate was that the Dems would have 50 seats left. Now, I think that's optimistic, but that was actually, but that was genuinely the, not our prediction, that was actually from electoral calculus and other pollsters saying this is what would happen.
Well, no doubt we shall see. Let's just concentrate for a minute, Randy, on one policy that was announced this week, a little bit of red meat for the Tories, cop killers to get life without parole, throw away the key. That's going to happen, isn't it? I think she'll be able to get that through.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she'll get that through, but it's grandstanding, really. I mean, she got booed the last time she arrives at the Police Federation. They've got a pretty unpalatable message to a pretty powerful trade union, which is we're going to take away your pensions and not give you any pay rises. And by the way, you're going to be undercut by cheaper labour in the police. Do you mind that? Oh, and by the way, we'll privatise some stations. So that's a pretty difficult message. So she comes along and says, tell you what, no, anybody who takes you on in using lethal force will be locked away for life, and I mean it. So will it change? I mean, we've lost one police officer the last decade every year. Will it affect those people who kill people? No, there's a 30-year tariff at the moment. Why should a child killer who gets 15 years on minimum tariff get less than a police officer? I mean, this is a sort of dangerous game of arms escalation, and it's really just to save Theresa May's kind of popularity.
Nodding away, Melissa.
Well, only because I'm interested in the principle it establishes. And May says that she wants to do this because killing a police officer, murdering a police officer in the course of their duty represents an attack on the fundamental basis of our society. That's the quote. Mm-hmm. Well, if that is so, then what about an act of terrorism? You know, I mean, there are so many...
Or killing a judge, or killing any
public servant at all, a teacher in a classroom, or injuring a teacher. You know, where do you draw the line?
Will it work for her in terms of, you know, these dissatisfied people on the backbenches you're talking about?
Well, funnily enough, there's a lot of admiration for Theresa May. I'm very surprised by how she's turned her image with her own party around, because they used to rather sneer at her and say she was sort of boring and dull and bland, and now there is a grudging and growing respect for Theresa May as somebody who has sort of put their head down and got on with the job and by and large done all right and achieved a few sort of tangible successes in government. So I think the Tories already have a sort of growing affection, maybe too strong a word, but you know, she's done all right, and she was, after all, tipped rather hysterically as a potential leadership challenger recently when there was that little frisson about her.
So no disaster for her, Stephen. I mean, for the Liberal Democrats, though, this is dire, which they've signed up. This is dire, isn't it? I mean, I remember past Liberal manifestos saying we'll abolish all mandatory sentences, all mandatory life sentence for murder to go. Never mind this, throw away the key, give up any hope of redemption. I mean...
Yeah, no, it's not good from a Liberal or Liberal Democrat point of view. I mean, of course, the walls were breached by Labour in the Criminal Justice Act in 2003. That's when the first whole life mandate tariffs were brought in for certain categories. But Randeep's right that once you actually start saying, once you draw that line, the temptation is always to draw it a little bit further down the line. And then it becomes really difficult for a politician to stand up and say, well, no, of course, you know, we can't possibly say that you can't lock up and throw away the key when someone kills a police officer, because then you want police officers to be killed then, is the kind of the next, when did you stop beating up your wife kind of question that comes our way. So it puts Liberals in a difficult position. The basic tenet should still remain that I think if crimes aren't premeditated and if there is some hope of rehabilitation, then you want to make sure that there is the chance for people to get out of jail. And not least because then there becomes the risk to prison officers themselves that if you give people who are convicted no hope, then the chances are they'll be that much more dangerous in prison.
There's no fear either.
There's no fear. And so there's this guy, Douglas Finter, who was convicted in 2008 after two murders, so given the whole life tariff, and he went and stabbed the guy who killed Sarah Payne. And what did he say when he was asked about this? I'm beyond the reach of the law, because there's nothing more that can be done to him. There's no capital punishment there.
Compelling.
So it's just that he's been given the final possible sentence that he could be. Where do you go next?
Where do the Liberal Democrats go next? Having compromised, obviously, on the economy is one thing. It's a technical argument. Different economists take different views. But the Liberal Party, Liberal Democrats and Liberal Party before it would always have been united on this kind of thing. And yet Nick Clegg signed off on it. Does that spell trouble for him?
Does it spell trouble? I don't know on that. I don't know whether it's because it plays to a populist issue, I think it makes it that much harder. And I think even Lib Dem activists who are deeply disappointed will be recognising that it's a hard one for the Lib Dems to kind of make a stand. You're not going to bring down the coalition on the basis of not wanting to convict police officers in that way. So I think people will be understanding it's a difficult issue. But yeah, it's breaching liberal principles. It comes back to the idea that you had the coalition agreement. That was meant to be the five-year programme for government. And what's happened instead is that gradually laws have been introduced as you go along the way, which don't have that popular mandate that the Lib Dems got in May 2010 from their members. And so every single one that comes along causes grief with some activists, and this one will as well.
OK, let's leave that there for now. There's plenty more at guardian.co.uk politics. This time last year, François Hollande swept to power in Paris with a mission to clean up French politics and see the country back to prosperity. Things have not gone well. This week, the country re-entered recession, unemployment's at more than 10%, and his own popularity is at record lows. Angélique Chrysaphis is in Paris. A year ago, if I remember right, François Hollande motored up in the rain and turned up looking pretty bedraggled and wet, but promised a return of the economic sunshine, didn't he?
He did, and thunderstorm has been the great cliche of his presidency, but it's not going away. He's currently the least popular of any modern French leader, and this popularity poll nightmare is clinging to him. I mean, the latest we've had this week is that France has gone back into recession, and France has been in trouble economically for the last 5 years, and it's been in and out of recession. But things are looking incredibly grim for 2013, and he really is at panic stations now because the popularity is plummeting. He's 1 year in. The real problem he faces is that people here don't really understand what he's doing. He came to power as this great sort of anti-austerity crusader that would save Europe, and in fact, half of French people polls show don't actually know where the government's going economically. And the real problem for him here is unemployment. No French leader has managed to be liked when the country is struggling with joblessness, and we're at 10%, 3.2 million, absolutely record-breaking levels. He's promised to reverse this rising trend in unemployment by the end of the year. He's still clinging to that promise, and about 82% of French people just don't believe him.
And people really do pin it on him, do they? I mean, it's obvious that there's a kind of European-wide slump going on.
Well, exactly. I mean, his government is saying, look, it's Europe, it's not just us. Now, the real problem with François Hollande is if you think about why he was elected, I mean, he was elected, a large part of people who voted for him were rejecting Nicolas Sarkozy sort of personally. That's made things even harder for Hollande, and he's actually starting to lose support amongst the left as well. Far from becoming this crusader that was changing the way Europe would go on the economy, France is even more than it ever was before, you know, at the mercy of Brussels, basically. Hollande had promised that he would bring down France's budget deficit to below the EU limit, which is 3% of economic output. He's failed that, and they've asked for another 2 years. Brussels has said, OK, you know, France is too big to sink. But the problem is Brussels is now really putting on the pressure for structural reforms. What does that mean? It means that France has, at long last, to actually get to grips with one of its biggest problems, which is this, what many people see as a fantastic welfare state, generous unemployment benefits, generous pensions, a big state healthcare system. They're going to have to start chipping away at that to try and find a solution to their budgetary problems, and that is really a nightmare. If François Hollande tackles pensions, as he's promising to do now, he's got no choice. This would be the first time that the French left has ever dealt with pensions. And I don't know if you can remember, each time it's ever happened before, each time anyone's tried to change pension systems in France, massive, massive street protests. It's a really difficult point in François Hollande's presidency.
But of course, electorally, you had the presidential election and then very soon afterwards parliamentary election where Hollande's Socialist Party did rather well and is governing. So is there a crisis that could take place if this record unpopularity continues, or does the constitution kind of lock him and his government down for a number of years?
Well, this is this great paradox about François Hollande. He has the biggest concentration of power. Well, not him personally, but the left has the biggest power base it has ever had. It has an absolute majority in Parliament. It has a majority in the Senate for the first time ever, and a very powerful presidency. It also controls, you know, most of the big cities from Paris to Toulouse in terms of mayors. So if they can't do what they want to do now, when can they, is the big question. You've got a few people on the left of the Socialist Party really falling out with Hollande over whether his social democratic tendencies are too sort of centre, even to the right. They're not he's not left-wing enough for some. For others, he's going in the opposite direction. So the point is, there are no local elections this year. Nothing's going to happen electorally in France till next year with the local elections and the European elections. They've kind of got a clean slate. So a lot of people are saying, well, if you can't do it now when you've got a clean slate, when can you do it? But MPs are getting very, very worried. Sorry, not MPs, more like councillors and mayors are getting pretty worried about the municipal elections coming up. I think he's in a difficult position personally as well, because his personal style is conceived by the public to be dithering. Sarkozy was the absolute opposite of that, sort of super speedy Sarko. Hollande is a consensus builder. Neither of those options seem to be inspiring much confidence in the French public, who've decided that, you know, neither of those styles of personality have managed to fix France. And Hollande promised that he would calm down the divisions and tensions in French society. He hasn't managed to do that, because his gay marriage bill proved massively divisive. And he then had a budget minister and tax collector in chief who lied about having a secret tax dodging bank account in Switzerland. So, you know, he hasn't managed to do several things, and this is a country just ruled by popularity polls, and the ratings are really just plunging.
Does it feel to you that France is turning very Eurosceptic? Because if the sense is that the right failed with Sarkozy, the left's failing with Hollande in terms of doing what people want, what do you do? You can't blame the right or left. So, do you blame the Germans?
Well, there's this very sort of tense relationship between Merkel and Hollande at the moment. Merkozy, which was Sarkozy and Merkel were kind of working arm in arm. The tension doesn't come from a personal tension, because actually Hollande and Merkel, character-wise, are not that far apart. But there's this sort of push and pull in France about how far Berlin wants them to go in structural reforms, and how far France should take Germany as a model, and whether or not Hollande could be a Schroeder by sort of laying the basis for great change in the economy and then being kicked out at the next election, perhaps. But I think in France there's a real acceptance that there needs to be reform. There's this idea that France is impossible to reform. I think conversely, people know that there needs to be a change, because they're really feeling it in terms of being able to make ends meet. And so it's not that they're necessarily turning against Europe. It's more also that they're kind of saying, look, that's not an excuse, François Hollande. Brussels isn't an excuse anymore. You've really got to come up with the goods. It's quite nuanced.
Angelique Chrysaphis there. Well, that's all we've got time for. My thanks to Stephen Tall, Melissa Kite and Randeep Ramesh. Politics Weekly is back next week, and don't forget, you can find us now on soundcloud.com. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark, and thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.